On this special episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, recorded during the New Jersey Association of ASC's annual conference in East Brunswick, New Jersey, we interview state association leaders in New Jersey and discuss issues affecting New Jersey ambulatory surgery centers.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a biweekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource the regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys. Welcome to episode 56 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for May 29th, 2019, recorded live from the New Jersey Ambulatory Surgery's annual conference in East Brunswick, New Jersey. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the leading experts in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. And he is the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including the Survey Guide for ASCs. John also speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics. So we had a really nice time at the New Jersey Association of Ambulatory Surgery Centers meeting. As we said, we were there, and we were pretty honored. They really
treated
gave
us
a nice spot to do our podcast and brought a lot of people in for us to talk to, so it was nice.
We also had this huge room
with
a conference table. I mean, it could have fit. Well, the entire company could have been there, actually, I think. And we always seem to have these big rooms that would be nice for doing podcasts when we don't have the whole crew with us. So, yeah. But anyway, thank you so much for our friends at the New Jersey Association. Mm-hmm. You know, the conference moved to the Hilton East Brunswick because the association was getting so large that they couldn't be accommodated in the prior digs. So, and it also provided a lot more space for exhibitors. And I'll tell you, we really had a lot of fun just talking to the exhibitors. We never had time during the ASC Association, the ASCA conference this year to meet. Well, at least I didn't have the time to meet with them. And here we had a great opportunity. And we, in episode 55, which we recorded just a few minutes ago, but which will be two separate episodes for all of you listeners, we talked a little bit about some of the people we met there. I'm not going to repeat that here. But
we did meet some nice people, so. And John, you were the keynote. Do you want to talk a little bit about your speech?
Sure. So, as everybody knows, I have real passion for the governing body and the responsibilities and the importance of recognizing the responsibility of the administrator to make sure the governing body knows what their responsibilities are. Mm-hmm. So, I spent a good hour talking about those responsibilities and how an administrator can really prepare the governing body for their responsibilities. So, you know, one of the things I mentioned is the importance of really comprehensive minutes. As we know, a surveyor cannot determine that an ASC is meeting the requirements, that the governing body is meeting the requirements to demonstrate that they're in full control of the activities of the ASC, except through the minutes. The minutes are the only documentation they have. So you need to have comprehensive minutes. And those minutes need to be as long as they need to be in order to reflect all of the activities. I think it's important, too, that many of the governing body meetings certainly include an awful lot of discussion about the financial activities of the of the governing body. And we need to make sure that our minutes don't reflect only the financial activities. Mm-hmm. So one of the suggestions I always make is make sure your minutes start with the quality improvement discussion, the activities of the quality improvement committee, and then, you know, end with the financial discussion, even if the board meeting itself is slightly different in that format.
You made the point there, too, that even if you're not spending a lot of time talking about the QI stuff, you've probably done that throughout the quarter. You know, you've gone to the different members when issues have come up. So it's not as though it's misleading.
Right.
It's just that when you get there, a lot of that has been discussed. You kind of quickly review it and talk about what needs to be spoken about, and then...
And everybody makes their final decisions if there's any decisions that need to be made. And those QI decisions need to be outlined in the minutes of the governing body. For example, if as a result of some activities of the Quality Improvement Committee, you need to make changes to the policies and procedures, the governing body, of course, has to approve those policies and procedures. And if some discipline was required as a result of this, there probably should be some discussion in the governing body minutes as to how administration followed through on the activities and any disciplinary actions, and the governing body would just like agree with the activities or the actions of the administration. We know that CMS requires only an annual meeting of the governing body, but that is really not appropriate to only have an annual meeting. You really need to have something more frequently. I say that you need at least quarterly meetings in order to be able to demonstrate all the responsibilities of the governing body are being carried out. So let's take a short break, and we have a series of interviews that we did during the New Jersey Association meeting.
John, ambulatory healthcare strategies is really growing fast. We've been adding employees steadily over the past 12 months. Can you tell the listeners what's been happening?
So clearly, this podcast has been very popular, thanks, of course, to you and me, because of our wonderful work here and our infectious, I don't know if I should be using infectious personalities in a podcast here about infection control and various items, but definitely we're enjoying doing this, and certainly the word is getting out about the great things that we're doing at AHS. So recently, we added infection prevention consulting to our services and mentoring of infection control preventionists in the organizations, and that's being headed up by Lori Rodericks, who is our newly certified CAIP individual. So she has the Certified Ambulatory Infection Preventionist certification now, and she's always been doing infection control for us, but now she's got this new title. So she can do ongoing infection control consulting, particularly if you don't have a qualified IC person on staff. She can help you in following up on infection control issues. She can do mentoring of infection control staff. And she can do infection control and sterile processing competencies. And we've also enhanced our life safety services by adding Jim Masters to our staff. He is a life safety surveyor, and so he joins Alex Borneman, who is our director of operations, to be able to do various life safety surveys and consulting on life safety issues, as well as probably the most important thing is follow up on life safety citations. That's a very difficult area for many organizations to be able to deal with. You know, what happens when you get a life safety citation? How do you deal with that? So we now have that ability. And of course, our unique retainer-based regulatory services, where we help keep you on top of all the ASC regulatory requirements and always make sure that you are survey ready.
During the New Jersey Association meeting, Nina Dietrich with Nina Dietrich LLC, a public relations and marketing communications company, talked about preparing for unfavorable press coverage. Nina works with the New Jersey Association to advise the organization and its members about how to respond to negative news coverage, and she's been instrumental in helping them through some recent coverage issues, including the USA Today article that came out in early 2018 that made news for about 24 hours, and then it really just disappeared because it didn't get any traction.
Right, and we did talk about it during an episode back during that time.
Yeah, but it was just so poorly researched. Luckily, it kind of just faded away.
Right.
And the 2018 incident where an ASC had to notify over 3,000 patients when the New Jersey Department of Health identified significant issues in their sterile processing department practices. So Nina spoke to us about how she works with the centers in New Jersey to address issues that come up with the media. So let's listen to that. John and I are here with Nina Dietrich, LLC. She's a public relations consultant with the New Jersey Association of Ambulatory Surgery Centers. Hi,
Nina.
Good
morning.
Good morning.
So, Nina, tell us a little bit about what you do with the New Jersey Association.
My role is really to raise visibility for the association among both the general public as well as potential members, to share what the purpose, the mission is of the association, and to serve as a voice for the industry when, you know, media call on us for, for stories that they're working on.
So New Jersey is an exciting state. Obviously, a lot of things have been going on. So what have been some of the things that you've had to deal with over the last couple years?
Certainly. You know, New Jersey is really sort of a bellwether, I think, for the industry in many ways because we're so highly regulated here. And so, you know, we're always sort of navigating that conversation. And even though, you know, the sphere of media is getting smaller and smaller every day, it seems, they are, you know, much more intent on reporting sometimes the challenging news to the industry. That seems to be a greater focus of the press these days. And so, you know, that makes my job a little bit more focused in terms of managing crisis communications for the association and making sure we're getting out as much positive information and true information as possible.
So probably one of the bigger challenges you had this year was with regard to the infection issue in New Jersey. So how did the association step up? I know there was a lot of press coverage.
Certainly. Yes, there has been. I think the most important thing is to be transparent and accessible. I think the media really value that kind of relationship, and that can make a whole lot of difference in the kind of coverage that results. In terms of, you know, how we've handled some of these bumps in the last year or two, again, it was just making our experts available and providing as much data as we could. You know, I think you may have actually heard me say this in the past that, you know, if you don't tell your story first, somebody else is going to, and they're going to get it wrong. Yeah. So it is very important to be accessible. Otherwise, you know, then it leaves room for a lot of misinformation to be circulated, and given social media, that information can be recirculated for a really long period of time. So we did spend a fair amount of time in the last 24 months getting those messages out.
So, of course, a problem could occur at any time, and the members will be able to call upon services such as yours if something were to happen. So kind of run through what a member would do if a problem occurs and they're called upon by the press.
Certainly. We do take those kinds of calls fairly often. You know, I think the first thing you have to do is think about constituencies that you have to communicate to when a problem arises. It's not just the press. It's your patients. It's your referring physicians. It's, you know, people sitting in the waiting room with those patients. Yeah. You have to really take a 360-degree look at all of the people that you need to be communicating to, including your staff, because they're also speaking for you or should not be speaking for you, depending on the nature of the matter. And so, you know, the first step is to sit down and list out who are all the audiences we need to talk to. Let's get all the facts about what happened. What don't we know as well? That's as important as what we do know. And then we start to craft those messages. The messages have to be consistent among all of the audiences. There really shouldn't be any difference. There's some nuances, of course, but otherwise the message has to be consistent across all of that. And then we have to assign a spokesperson. And whether that communication is going to come in the form of a patient letter or an email blast or picking up the phone and calling, you know, your top 10 most important referring physicians to your center, that may be a move. It's not just communicating to the media. So we have to sort of think about all of that and the timing of that. And given the nature of the internet, certainly, and, you know, social media, responding quickly is really important. We don't have a day to respond anymore. We used to, you know, now it's just hours, if it's that. And so the communication may come in phases.
So that brings up an actually interesting topic. This morning I was, during my speech, I was talking about the importance of being prepared, you know, for issues. We're talking about drills, in fact, and talking about the importance of making sure that people are prepared for any type of thing by drilling constantly. And it just, it strikes me that I don't think we've ever done a drill where, you know, you're a drill with regard to a media response, which would be more of a tabletop type drill. So just running that scenario, what would you suggest? Because as you said, it's too late to be thinking about this when the issue occurs. What types of steps do you think an organization should go through to develop policies and procedures and perhaps to drill, to practice what they would do if a media occurrence?
I'm so glad you asked that question. Yeah. It really doesn't get as much consideration as it should. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always called in at the 11th hour, but Ideally, you want to know who your spokesperson is. You're going to want to have everybody's emergency contact information first and foremost. You're going to want to have a policy in place about what staff, administration, and the physicians alike need to do should there be a problem. Ideally, nobody should be talking to the press except the one designated spokesperson. You want to have your contact information for your attorneys, your insurance companies, your PR or marketing people, all handy, sort of in an emergency list. You want to have basic information about your center already written up so that can just be plugged in as needed. It's amazing how much time it takes to put something like that together when everybody's really busy and focused on other things.
And you need to keep that up to date because things change.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so just having some of those basic policies in place, what are you going to do if a camera shows up? Well, you can't disseminate that policy after the crisis hits. You should be talking about what to do if you have a television crew show up at your door and it happens far more than you'd like to think about it.
Right. This has been great. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
So I think the takeaways from that are we need to be prepared for creating policies about who should respond when the call comes in from the press. And as we talked about in episode 55, consider using a media inquiry as a drill for your staff and act out how you would respond when that type of a phone call comes. So. Mm-hmm. Next, we interviewed Meg Stagliano. She is the vice president of the board of the New Jersey Ambulatory Surgery Association, and she talked about infection control and sterile processing and the New Jersey requirements for ASCs related to infection prevention. So New Jersey is really taking a lead role, I think, nationally with regard to infection prevention, and the Department of Health is taking a lead role working with the New Jersey Association and, in fact, held a conference, special conference, about 2 months ago about this. So let's listen to Meg's comments. So we're at the New Jersey State Association meeting in East Brunswick, New Jersey on May 29th, and I'm here with Meg Stagliano, who is with Surgical Care Affiliates, and she's one of the members of the board of New Jersey Association. Welcome, Meg.
Thank you.
So you're actually doing a session here on infection control. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that session and what's going on in your area?
So recently we did a training for new infection preventionists to give them the education in New Jersey. They're required to have some additional training to be the on-site infection preventionist. In addition, we are required to have a certified CIC consultant that they work with. So we did the initial training with the Department of Health that they needed. And today's session is to tell them, okay, you've now had the training. How do you actually now go out and be the infection control nurse at your center?
Right.
So what are the responsibilities of the infection control nurse? How do you get an authority statement from the board? What should the job description include? And then what are the things you need to do? The infection control risk assessment, the infection control plan, and then what types of monthly monitoring should you be doing?
So, of course, I work with the BASC board and the new infection prevention credential known as CAIP, C-A-I-P, which I understand New Jersey has not accepted yet.
They have not, but we have asked them to, and so they are considering it.
Good. So that would be a very a good development for the industry, I think, and for these organizations. Nothing against CIC, but they really are much more hospital-oriented. So you had a very unique conference recently with the Department of Health, where you talk to aspiring infection preventionists as well as anybody interested in infection prevention. How did that go?
It was actually very good. We talked about basic infection control issues, but then we recently had in the news a surgery center in New Jersey that had to notify over 4,000 patients that they were potentially exposed to HIV, hepatitis, and communicable diseases. And so that really spurred the conversation of what also happens if you have an infection control breach. And so how does the Department of Health work with the CDC to look at that and to determine if patient notifications are needed, what types of notifications, and then what the responsibility and follow-up of the ASC would be for that type of situation?
Understood. And the Department of Health has been very forthright in Working with you has been very proactive in working with you and very helpful.
Correct? Yes. Yeah, they actually helped us put together the program. They co-sponsored the event, and they actually recruited about half of the speakers for the event.
Right. And now, is this something you intend to do on a regular basis with DOH, or is this a one-time?
So we are going to do an annual infection control event.
Good, good. So in New Jersey, what do you need to do in order to demonstrate? So, I mean, we know the federal regulation requires you to have an infection preventionist with detailed with training specific to the ASC industry, but it doesn't require an actual credential. It doesn't require you to pass a test. New Jersey's slightly different, but you have to have somebody that's certified, but that person doesn't have to be on your staff, correct?
Correct. So you have to have someone that has CIC certification, and you can either choose to take someone from your center and train them, and they actually have 2 years from the time of training to pass the CIC exam, or you can have someone that is a CIC that is your consultant, and then you have someone that has, it just says additional training in infection control,
right.
Who is your on-site person that works with your CIC in rolling out your infection control plan.
So in an average center that doesn't have a CIC on staff, how often would that CIC consultant, I guess you would say, work with the on-site infection preventionist?
So in New Jersey, we're actually required to have the CIC come and do quarterly rounds on the facility. And so at a minimum, they would work with the staff on a quarterly basis.
Okay. And if the CAIP credential becomes applicable here, then that would, that CAIP person would replace that CIC person in that role. And of course, what we'd really like to encourage, as we've been doing on this podcast, is make sure that people go for the CAPE credential. The CAPE credential is specific to the ambulatory surgery industry, and really it's a great way of proving both to the federal regulators, the CMS, and the accreditation organizations, but it sounds like even the state, if they accept it.
That New Jersey started this requirement about 7 years ago, and at the time, they didn't realize how hard it would be for people to actually get CIC certified, and also how specific it was to hospitals. And so a lot of people such as myself started down the path with good intent thinking, okay, I will get the training from APIC and I'll go and sit for the exam. But it turns out if you don't have experience in epidemiology and certain things that you wouldn't have exposure to unless you worked in a hospital, that you're really, you know, setting yourself up for failure and not going to pass the exam. So I think having the CAPE would be an excellent, you know, resource because it is specific to surgery centers and exactly, you know, what we're dealing with.
Well, and just to give more information, if you're interested in more information about the CAPE credential, that's CAIP credential, go to aboutcape.org on the internet and you get all kinds of information. The next test is coming up and we'd really encourage everybody to do that. Thank you so much, Meg. It's been a pleasure having you on our podcast.
Thank you.
So the thing I really enjoyed about this interview is the way she said she helps to take people from just having the knowledge and the training and helps them to put it into practice. Because I think that's a lot of times with these new roles like this, you're not quite sure what the actual requirements are. So she really took that step by step and broke it down. What should you be doing and how often you should be doing it? I think that's very useful.
Right. And again, New Jersey seems to be taking a real lead in this. Since I work on the program for New York, I've been trying to do the same thing with New York, and we're rolling that out with the upcoming conference this week in New York. So New Jersey's already done it, and Meg really did a nice job of pulling that together, both in her the speech that she did as well as her interview with us. So next, we interviewed my dear friend, Andrew Weiss, who is the immediate past president of the New Jersey Association. And Andrew talked about some of the activities of the board and the association over the last year. So let's listen to him. So this is John Gailey. I'm recording from the New Jersey Association in East Brunswick on May 29th. I'm here with my dear friend, Andrew Weiss. Andrew and I serve together on the BASC board. He is currently the board president. I am the immediate past president, a position I very much love right now. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, John. Good to see you again.
So tell me what's going on in New Jersey. You got a couple important issues going on. I know out-of-network is still an issue. And, of course, the fallout from the new licensing requirements for single special. Let's start with out-of-network. What's going on with out-of-network?
Yeah, and I think that one tenet about being a healthcare provider that we all have to think about is, to some degree, we are all out-of-network. Maybe more have a truism to that than others, but you know, you're not participating in 100% of all plans in the state, that can't happen. So if you think that the out-of-network doesn't touch you, you've got to kind of look long and hard at that statement.
Yeah.
The association worked long and hard to make this bill, which had been proposed for at least 10 years, probably longer, which would basically keep the cost, i.e. reimbursement, down to providers, to make it a palatable piece of legislation. And mm-hmm. part of what we do have to live with is a notification process. So the department has given us, I believe it's 5 pages of notification for patients,
yeah.
you know, and of course that has to also start in the physician's office, and we're all, yeah. you know, looking to comply.
And it's very confusing information, very confusing for the
yeah.
patient.
Yeah, it is. And I think the one thing to remember about regulations in New Jersey Department of Health, they're not unreasonable people, and I know that's an arguable statement. But I think it's all about intent. And, yeah. and I think the intent to comply is carries a lot of weight, and that's been my experience over the years. If you're using the forms that have been provided, if you're trying your darndest to make it fit into your center, some elements might not work out. You know, there's some information about you need to get a consent sign that you notified a patient about a non-ERISA plan. And I think I know what a non-ERISA plan yeah. is, but it's how do you determine that when you're yeah. trying to schedule a patient? My advice is do your best to show compliance. So that's the one element that we're struggling with right now. I know nationally there's going to be they're calling it the surprise medical bill yeah. situation. You know, I don't know how much of this is going to overlap with what you know the state has done.
But. Yeah, well, President Trump just recently proposed that, which kind of came out of nowhere. We didn't realize that he was mm-hmm. even thinking about this sort of thing. So it's and actually, I'm pretty supportive of it. I mean, just
absolutely
some of the issues that we have. I think it's a major thing that'll hopefully equalize what's going on in the industry.
Yeah, and again, it's probably not as apropos in our industry as it is folks coming into an ER or getting an anesthesia.
Where they have no choice.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. But we all get, you know, listen, we all get painted with the same brush. We have to stand together with, you know, all providers and, you know, trying to support regulation and legislation that makes the sense for all of us. I mean, a rising tide will raise all ships.
Yeah.
You know, and to try to be as critical about other providers, I think is probably not the best strategy to take in this day and age.
Right. So I can't believe I'm saying this, but last year when we spoke on the podcast, we spoke about I can't believe that we're over a year and yeah. a half doing this stuff now. Last year when we spoke, it was really the first year of implementation of the licensure requirement. So what's been learned? What's going on? What's in the future?
Well, some people are still waiting for their licenses
yeah.
that applied back then. And again, we have to take a look back. Why do we have this bill? Why
yeah.
did this legislation come about? And if you look back about 10 years ago, for those of you that aren't as familiar with the bill, the facilities that only had one OR were not licensed, would not be, and theoretically could not be licensed. So the Board of Medical Examiners held the responsibility. You know, we had a bifurcated system. We had 2 standards, not 1 standard of care.
Right.
My clinical colleagues, you know, will always say that you can't have a dual standard of care,
right.
and they're right. So our association, in the interest of patient safety, if nothing else, you know, has always supported legislation that would provide 1 licensing system and process. We try also very, very hard to work with the department to not make the transition so onerous mm-hmm. that facilities would literally go out of business. They couldn't comply. And there was a lot of give and take with that. But unfortunately, there's a very diverse set of circumstances that or conditions that facilities, you know, have evolved into, and you as a surveyor, you know, can mm-hmm. see there's no such thing as a typical ASC.
Right, absolutely. So what have been some of the challenges? So first of all, one of the biggest challenges is they don't have the resources. The state doesn't have the resources
right.
to survey, what is it, about 300 centers
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
are coming on board?
Yeah. Yeah, so a lot of them have been on the life safety and the physical plant requirements. And again, the department is in defense of them, they're trying to feel this out. They're trying to, you know, promulgate legislation that was handed to them. They're trying to do the right thing in the interest of patient safety. You know, this is part of the delay. The other part is, you know, again, they through retirements and such, they've, you know, lost a good number of people that they're looking to replace. But it is very frustrating for those that are trying to be in compliance with the law, trying to get some answers, and they're finding that, you know, a lot of times they're just hitting a brick wall. It will straighten out. No one likes delays, and you and I have been through enough implementation of
yeah.
centers to know that it just seems so agonizing. But the association is working with the department to try to you know, make sure that they understand that, you know, back to intent. Our intent is to comply mm-hmm. with the regulations. Please tell us what they are.
Right.
So, you know, if you're not getting anywhere, if you're in New Jersey, you're, you know, you're trying to get a some answers, you know, reach out to us at the association.
Right.
You know, because you're probably not, you don't have to go this alone. Your challenges are probably not unique. There's other people in the state feeling the same pressure right now.
Well, and the state association has really stepped up on the educational side too, and the mm-hmm. outreach to these new members. Now, do you have new members as a result of this? Were they members before, or are they or not?
No, actually, our membership has definitely increased during this time period as folks realize that we are a resource that we can help with access. We can help with, you know, with providing some answers and some information and you know, and also a voice. You know, we need our members to be active as any association does.
Right.
So, you know, it's nice because we've not only seen new members as our memberships increase, but we've have more active members, more voices, more people that have come in. So it's been a good year for us.
Very good. Yeah. Thank you so much, Andrew. I appreciate your time.
Anytime, John.
So thank you, Andrew. As always, you're a great friend, and we always love talking to you. And so our next speaker was John Fanberg, who is the counsel to the New Jersey Association, and he counsels them on advocacy at the legislative and administrative levels of the state. So let's listen. This is John Gailey. I'm speaking from the New Jersey State Association meeting on May 29th in the Hilton in East Brunswick, and I'm here with John Fanberg, who's the corporate counsel for the New Jersey Association. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, you just finished a session here about what's going on in the state with regard to you know, various legal issues. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you talked about and what's important now to the state association members?
Sure. What seems to be really on the front burner for a lot of the association members is, frankly, a lot of frustration with the New Jersey Department of Health in terms of their licensing.
Yeah. You're referring to the new licensing requirements that licenses single rooms,
which were registered surgical practices. So by January 15th of 2019, every registered surgical practice had to file an application for licensure. So a lot came in the last days. Now, the law changed about a year ago, so many applied back into early 2018. In fact, I have one client that filed in February of 2018 and still hasn't even gotten a phone call from the Department of Health. So registration and getting licensure is one thing, but there are a number of transactions that are occurring because one of the benefits of being licensed is you can monetize your surgery center in terms of a sale mm-hmm. or allow non-physicians to invest. They can't close on those transactions until these centers are licensed. So a lot of these transactions are being held up because of understandable delays, but they're still very frustrating. The delays are primarily caused by a significant amount of turnover in the Department of Health within a very short period of time. We've never seen this happen so substantively in such a short period of time. So it's really in disarray.
Yeah. And they're running behind and obviously doing the survey. So once you put the application in, what happens after the application is filed with the Department of Health?
You typically wait for a phone call from an analyst to go through the application, and usually they'll have either questions or they'll be missing some things.
Yeah.
In which case, the center then answers the questions or submits additional information to assist the analyst. Once the analyst signs off, then there's an inspection.
Okay.
And the inspection is scheduled usually within 1 or 2 months of the analyst saying the application is complete. Once the survey is done, usually the surveyors will find something wrong because they have to. But usually it's corrected within a short period of time. And then they get a letter, yes, you are now licensed.
Okay.
That time frame, in a perfect world, probably shouldn't take more than 90 to 120 days. But as I said earlier, I have a client who filed an application in February 2018, and here we are on the cusp of June 2019, hasn't even heard.
Yeah.
I've heard some that have moved very quickly. So we're beginning to think, and this was kind of confirmed by the Department of Health this morning, that the problem may be the analysts. Now, some analysts have more work that they can take on because they've lost a few people, but apparently there's some analysts that are not really working as hard as we would want.
Right.
So we try not to litigate against the Department of Health, but we're getting to the point where they're not giving us any chance because they're holding up business in progress in the state of New Jersey. Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, this is a benefit of the state association members to access to information from your company and to you, right? I mean, there are points at which the organization ought to pay, but this is a benefit of the state association membership.
Yes, it is, and we're very proud to have a longstanding relationship with the association. We attend all of their member meetings. We provide fairly extensive legal reports, which we provide highlights on mm-hmm. all of this. But it's more than the legal. I've been doing what I've been doing for over 35 years. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty entrenched in the healthcare delivery system in New Jersey, not just the ASC. So we also provide a certain amount of strategic planning, business advice. So it goes beyond the legal. But and we have a great collaborative relationship with the department and the other agencies that regulate ASCs, like the Board of Medical Examiners, like the Department of Banking Insurance. So it's a highly regulated field. And this group here today are trying to do the right thing. They're trying to be compliant. But when the analyst doesn't return the phone call and then the analyst supervisor doesn't return the phone call, it becomes frustrating because it's now beginning to cost money.
Right. Well, and I think a big message for our listeners out there that might not be members of the New Jersey Association is just recognize you don't need to go this alone. I mean, there's 300 organizations. Obviously, they're not all members of the state association here, and recognize you don't need to be going on your own to get yourself licensed and to define your pathway.
It's a very collaborative effort. And the other part, to your point, is the benefit value of the association. To believe I provide value, but we also have DOH representatives that come to every meeting. Gene Brennitz, who's been very helpful. We have the infection control people. We have other speakers on labor and employment issues in the ASC. So to get almost 250 people from all these surgery centers to share their experiences and for us to share with them how to wind their way through this environment, people walk away really feeling they've gotten a lot out of it for their membership dollar.
Yeah. What other issues are going on in the state that New Jersey ASC members should be concerned about or becoming hot topics?
Well, we're coming up to the one-year anniversary of Governor Murphy signing the out-of-network law, which impacts ASCs and physician practice and hospitals throughout the state. None of the agencies actually have had a chance to propose, let alone adopt regulations, even though the law became effective in August. So at today's meeting and at prior meetings, we're telling people how to best comply with the law without rules and regulations. And the out-of-network surprise bill law is now becoming a major issue in Washington.
Right.
And time was short, so I didn't get to mention that notwithstanding our 12-year effort to keep this from happening, ultimately did happen last year. Now it's being picked up on a national level. And how will the national change impact New Jersey?
Right, right.
I'm confident it won't. We have a very good law. It seems to be very fair. It's a little too new to really say whether it's working or not and how impactful it is on providers to comply. But so far, from the feedback I get, it's been workable.
Okay, John, it's been great having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for your information.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Thank you to John Fanberg for that information. And now we'll be speaking to the current president of the New Jersey Association, Jeff Shanton, who spoke about his take on the state association and their plans for the future.
This is John Gailey. I'm recording live from the New Jersey Association Ambulatory Surgery Center's annual conference in East Brunswick. I'm here with Jeff Shanton, who is the president of the New Jersey Association. Sorry,
okay.
You thought that we were recording a few seconds ago, and it wasn't going
and
on.
And I was rambling on and on, you know, like I like to do. So there you go.
So we want to talk a little bit about what's going on with the state association, the benefits of membership, and what have been some of the activities and challenges you've had over the last year.
Well, like I had said before, we've grown tremendously in the last 2 years. When I was elected president, I was determined that I was going to be a hands-on, proactive president. Nothing against my predecessors, but, you know, that's just the way it was. So I was determined that, you know, you have to grow membership. I mean, we were probably 90-ish centers or something like that when you consider there's over 300 in the state.
Right.
It's okay, but you know, we were just ambling along, you know, enough money to pay this and that, but not really to do things. So we had to increase membership for a lot of reasons. Well, we did. We're now over 150. Plus, we're kind of unique in, as a state organization, we have vendor members. So when you were walking out in the vendor area there. We had 50 vendors displaying, and we have, I think, 31 vendor members, which is a very, very nice infusion of revenue. But more importantly, I tell them, if you're going to join me as a vendor member, I don't want you for the money you're going to pay for the table here at this annual event. Yeah. You're part of us.
Right.
And I want to keep you for years and years. We have a vendor committee that meets and gets together that talks about things, reports back to the board. Vendors are on, like, the event committee that plans this event. They're on that. They're on program committee. They're on a lot of things. We get them in. We have them talk at quarterly meetings, you know, on areas of expertise, which is another thing the state organization does that others don't. We just don't have an annual event. We have quarterly membership meetings.
Right.
Okay. So when vendors join us, that's a benefit of their membership. They don't pay us to do. They get a table and they display, or any other educational events. We've had several each year. I'm very proud this year we did the inaugural infection control conference.
Which we heavily plugged on the ASC
in partnership
podcast,
with Department of Health. Mm-hmm. We sold out that conference in 24 hours.
Yeah.
In fact, the traffic was so tremendous and heavy that several times the registration website just broke down because they thought they were getting hacked.
Yeah.
You know, there was so much going in there. So, you know, after that, we had thought, well, geez, what are we going to do? Because, you know, we had 160 people. That's where our venue was. That's what we could have. So what we did is we came across a nice little video film group. They're out here now, McCallum. Talked to them and everything. They videoed it. They filmed it, edited it professionally. It's a professional film. So now you can go on our educational platform. You can pay. You can view that. And we have things built in that you can't game the system. You know, you have to go through everything. And then the system notifies us that you have completed it. You get a certificate. So you could, instead of being at the meeting physically to get your certificate, you could do that. And we're probably up to about 60 people that have actually used that. And I hear tell that, you know, ASCA is looking to you know, see if they can use it to incorporate it if anybody else, you know, in the country wants it or anything.
So, to include it in our training.
Yeah, so that's one of the, that's something that we're very proud of that, you know, we did this year.
Right. And then as for the annual conference, which we're actually recording from, this is a new venue this year. Tell us a little bit about the decision to move here. And,
well, the decision was we outgrew, which is a good thing. We outgrew where we were for the past 3 years. I mean, the place was nice enough. You were there.
Yeah.
But you were shoulder to shoulder. I mean, I had to turn vendors away last year, which, you know, grieved me tremendously.
Yeah.
And even in the ballroom, you know, I mean, there were people literally sitting on each other's lap. I mean, we just did not have enough room.
Yeah.
So the good thing about membership and having this is it gives you the financial wherewithal to do things.
Right.
And, you know, you see this venue. This is not a cheap venue, but you see the results, okay? Yeah, I mean, this is everything I wanted, you know, for an annual event and everything to brand this organization, you know, for what it is and what it really should be moving forward.
Right. So what are the benefits of membership? Now, you have, of course, I think an important thing right now to recognize is that with the new single room ASCs really needing additional support, a lot more support than they had before, definitely there's got to be a huge push getting them to become.
Well, it is, but I mean, it's an ongoing thing, whether we had the one room law or not. You know, our job as a trade organization is to advocate for the industry, which we do. We are big time in Trenton. We've always been that way. And in fact, when I first started coming to these meetings before I was on the board or anything else like that, I was always the one in the room that got up and said, well, no, wait, what about this law? What about that? Well, one of the ex-presidents said, you know what? We have no advocacy. You can become the Government Affairs and Advocacy Committee. Okay. So I then signed up Mark Manigan and some of our others, you know, got a lobbyist and all that kind of stuff. We're very, very, that's very important. That sets us off from anybody. And we've been very, very successful, you know, in lots of things. Like I say, that one room law, we wrote that law.
Right.
You know, obviously the legislators, you know, in the Senate and the Assembly, you know, went along with it and everything like that. But That was essentially something we wrote because we realized that a one room in the state of New Jersey, you had no value. Yeah. You had nothing. You had your one room, and what would that do?
Yeah.
It was not a sellable entity because there was no license, there was no anything like that. Now, that was our take when we wrote the bill. The real reason, you know, the reason that the bill had anything had actually come up was, you know, some kind of a bad expose about said centers, you know, maybe 7 years ago. So we said, okay, we truly believe that we should be, everybody should be on the same. You know, it doesn't matter if you have one room or if you have five rooms. You're the same. It doesn't really much matter. Yeah. So that was the real reason that we went in. But the secondary reason, which it took centers a while to understand, was the financial aspect. All of a sudden, you have something that's worth something. Because we put a clause in that law that allows what's called combination, not a selling of the license, but a combining. Mm-hmm. So what that means is a two-room center that all of a sudden is outgrown, well, you know, there's a moratorium in the state, been for years and years. You can't add a room. Well, now you can combine. In other words, you can take that one room, build a third, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because the whole idea is you are not increasing the number of ORs.
Right.
And the most important thing is if you were to buy a center, you have a radius of within you can relocate, which is only 20 miles. Combination, you can go anywhere. Yeah. Somebody could buy some from up in Wawa, could buy something in Cape May, and you could combine that way. So all of a sudden, doctors had real value from that perspective, but more importantly, now all of a sudden, national companies or hospital systems are looking at them.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some hospital systems out here that have been grabbing up one rooms by the dozen.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, something that was like, yeah, okay, it's nice, I'm practicing, it's mine. Hello there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are your goals for the next year as president?
I do have a specific goal. Unfortunately, I can't really talk about it that much, but it really, it's a big one that involves the Department of Health and regulations in the state of New Jersey and everything like that. You know, also continue the growth.
Right.
You know, want to continue the growth. And, you know, like I say to everybody on my board all the time, you have to have a benefit of membership. You know, that's very important. They need, you know, if they're going to pay me $1,600, we're not cheap.
Right.
There has to be a benefit for them, which I believe we do all the time. I mean, you know, every week they get a e-newsletter, you know, the news to know. I write that for them. You know, there's all kinds of stuff in there. They're constantly alerted of anything that's going on. You know, like I say, we have plenty of educational events, you know, and things like that. We're constantly advocating. So I think, you know, if you're an ASC in New Jersey, you get a lot of bang for your buck as a member.
Very good. Thanks so much, Jeff. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. So thank you, Jeff. It's always great speaking to him and to hear what's going on in the State Association. It's a very vibrant organization, a lot going on, and we're very proud to be a part of that. And last but not least, we have Bonnie Lavoie, who is the conference chair. This is her last time as conference chair, as a matter of fact, and she spoke a little bit about how the conference was organized. Let's listen.
This is John Gailey. We're recording from the New Jersey State Association meeting in East Brunswick on May 29th, 2019. And I'm here with Bonnie Lavoie, who is the program chair. And I understand, Bonnie, this is your last year as program chair.
Yes, I've been doing this for 9 years. It was my original baby when I got on the board over 10 years ago. It's just come such a long way.
Yeah.
And I'm semi-retired, and I'm kind of moving on to other things, and I will still be involved next year, I'm sure, in some sort of a consultative basis. Yeah. Where I've seen it come, where it is now, I'm very, very excited.
Well, look at this venue, the number of people that are here. I was the keynote in the beginning. I couldn't believe the number of people in the audience compared to this is probably the fourth year I think I've done this. It hasn't been consecutive, but you really have done great. This is a great venue.
It is. I'm really
once they fix the HVAC problem.
The food is wonderful too.
Yes. They did an excellent job. The committee is great. There's a lot of details that we've been writing down, so whoever takes it from me next year, it's all written down. They just got to follow the list. Yeah.
So what were some of the challenges that you had with preparing this year's session?
Well, getting speakers is always the prime focus, getting good speakers and topics that will attract attendees. Number two, getting CEUs.
Yeah.
AEUs, very difficult. AEUs is not so hard, but CEUs, very hard.
Right.
That took probably 6 months of detailed paperwork and going back and forth. And we got ours from ARN, right, which happens to be a little bit easier than the New Jersey Nurses Association, which we used before.
Yeah.
So that was a real challenge. Once we got that, then the rest is, you know, pretty much following the footprint of the other sessions that we've had.
So how many credits does everybody get depending upon their profession?
I think we had two approved for nursing credits.
Right.
And then I think there's nine approved for AESC, AEUs. And then this year we also put in two for the infection control,
right,
which is new for us. So
great,
the people who have gotten that infection control credential can use these also for their credits. So that was good.
Right. And Andrew, you're a media past president, myself, are members of the board of...
Yes.
Of BAS, the organization oversees the CAS credential and the CAPE,
yes,
credential, and we really appreciate the effort that the state association has to start offering the IPCH units,
yes,
in addition to AE units. So that's definitely another good reason for people to come.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is the prime benefit for attendees to come to this conference?
Absolutely, education,
yep,
networking. Network, like you said,
yeah,
you'll sit and talk to somebody and they'll say, oh, I had this great idea and it works for you.
Right.
Networking is great. The vendors are great. I,
yeah,
love to go to the vendor hall. I love seeing their products, getting your bag of goodies, and I always find somebody that I need to talk to afterwards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One or two vendors that I will call later on and try something, a new product or something. So I don't know, all of those areas I think are really good.
I have to make an admission to you. We just came back from the ASCA conference 2019, and we were very heavily involved in it, but I had no time to go through the vendor hall.
Oh.
I spent more time today meeting with your vendors than I did at ASCA. I just wanted you to know that,
yeah,
that was great. It's a great opportunity to talk to somebody, meet some new
people that have been
great. So, talk a little bit about the venue here and its location. So your intention is to continue using,
yes,
the Hilton here in,
yes,
East Brunswick.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What I liked is we wanted a venue where we could have a 2-day event.
Mm-hmm.
We need a place for people to stay. With trying to be centrally located and attract the southern ASCs and northern, it was just very difficult. This is a little more central, I feel. And having it 2 days allows the southern centers to come up, because otherwise it's a 3 or 4 hour drive,
yeah,
and they got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get here the day of.
Yeah.
So this gave them a chance, an opportunity to get there the night before. It gave the vendors a chance to set up and not have to rush in at 6 o'clock in the morning. So I needed a place where you had, you know, good rooms and we could do a 2-day event. So that's worked out very well for us.
Yeah, and Sue and I came in last night and we attended your casino night.
Yeah.
Now, we didn't do any gambling.
Yeah, first time we did that, yeah.
Too much other activities, yeah, going on, but the food was great.
Fun,
yeah.
Yeah, it was good. It was good.
Well, I got to tell you, we appreciate it. I'm on the keto diet, for anybody that cares, and which is a very restrictive diet. And I'll tell you, even at ASCA, we had some problems because, you know, there were so many carbohydrates here.
Yeah.
We were able to eat all the meals.
Yeah. So. There were some yummy-looking carbohydrates.
Yeah.
There was plenty to eat for us.
Well, one of our surveys in the past mentioned that they would prefer to have some more healthy kinds of food.
Mm-hmm.
So we took that, you know, we look at all those surveys,
right,
and we take it to heart. And when we plan for the next year, we look at those surveys and say, mm-hmm, here's what someone wants. And the food was key. So
yeah,
we did try to,
yeah,
make that effort.
Okay. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Bonnie. Appreciate
thank you,
your time.
John, and thank you both for being here so much.
Our pleasure.
Appreciate it.
As always.
So I do have to apologize for the slightly less quality of that.
Mm-hmm.
We were kicked out of our studio because they needed to use the room for a,
yeah,
speech. And,
well, which they very generously gave us.
That's right, right. That probably didn't come out well.
to step out. So.
Yeah, we had a nice setup there, and mm-hmm, but we hadn't had an opportunity by the time
to
that we had to
Bonnie.
Leave that studio, temporary studio, yeah, to interview Bonnie. And she was an extremely important part of this,
yeah,
and this was her last hurrah for
mm-hmm,
the committee. I'm sure she'll be involved in some way,
yes,
but she won't be planning it.
Yeah.
So,
we
thank
really
you.
Wanted to talk to her.
Absolutely. So we used some portable recording equipment,
mm-hmm,
and it was the best we could do. So, well, that's it for this special episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, recorded from the New Jersey Association. Join us again in a couple weeks and spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, All Rights Reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.